inherit the civilizations of before, the sciences of the previous nations, and suddenly they become the most advanced nation of their times. They were carrying the flag, carrying the flame of knowledge in general, not just knowledge of Sharia, all the other sciences as well. At the time when Europe was stagnating in the Dark Ages, they were the ones who were carrying the flag. So the Western academic tradition speaks about what? Ancient Greece, ancient Rome. And then suddenly there's this huge gap of several centuries, and then they jump to the Enlightenment of the 15th and 16th century. So what happened with all of those the 1,000 years in between? Well, that's where the untold story lies. That untold story is the story of how Islam took what was presented, took it and added its own coloration to it. In that particular course of events, they also developed this legal system of ours. This legal system of ours. So when they looked at it, they said, okay, the Muslims have philosophy. Well, they got that from Socrates and Aristotle and everyone else. And they have medicine. Well, that they got from the ancient Greeks, who got it from the ancient Indians. And everything else was somehow or the other given ancient Greco-Roman roots. Europe has this tendency. Anything good must be ascribed to Greco-Roman antiquity. Nothing could arise out of a particular nation as downtrodden as the Arabs. They couldn't come with something as wonderful as this. Therefore, they said, this legal system, the Arabs, these illiterate, uncouth, savage Arabs, must have simply copied from the legal Roman schools of Syria. But upon closer inspection, there is no relation between the two whatsoever. We look at where did our fuqaha study? Where did they acquire their knowledge from? There we had the silsila of tafaqqah of Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi alayhi. Till today when we read the books of fiqh, on whichever madhab it might happen to be, you do not find ascription to this non-Muslim source or that non-Muslim source. What you do find in there, this is such, لِقَوْلِهِ تَعَالَى كَذَا وَكَذَا. That is such, لِقَوْلِهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ كَذَا وَكَذَا. This is such because of this qiyas, because of the ijma of the ummah. Very little in it is reminiscent of anything Western. It is something that arose from where? It arose from the wahi that was revealed to him, الَّذِي لَا يَنْتِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحِنْ يُوحَىٰ. So this legal system, short space of time, it became the backbone of an empire. It became the backbone of an empire that would soon envelop the world from the Atlantic Ocean right up to in the heart of Central Asia. And wherever it might have been, whichever madhab it might have been upon, it's the same Quran, it's the same Sunnah, with the various different interpretations of the fuqaha in such cases where ikhtilaf was admissible and tolerable. If something ijma'i, no ikhtilaf is going to be tolerated upon there. Riba is haram, there's completely, there's no way out of it. But in certain other instances, fuqaha would differ. A person would take one opinion here, another person would take another opinion over there. Amongst the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, when the search started for an alternative to riba, now this how and why does riba arise as a phenomenon in society? It's because certain people have surplus money and certain people have a need for money. So the one comes to the other and says, I need money. You've got more than what you need and I need money. Islam says, is that permissible? 100% permissible as long as the conditions are maintained. What are the conditions? You give 100, you take 100. Nothing more, nothing less. Any little half a cent extra is going to be considered riba. So what do we have? Qard is permissible. The qard, hasan, permissible. The one who has excess, he is not just permitted to give to the one who does not have and who needs that particular money. Not only is he permitted, he is even encouraged to do so. There are hadith which indicate that qard is about 18 times superior to sadaqah. There's ikhtilaf on the siha of the hadith. Some ulama regard it as sahih, some regard it as not. But qard forms an integral aspect. The qard is a loan. Loans form an integral aspect not only of life but of our law books as well. There's no fiqh kitab that won't have a section on qard. There will be a section on qard because this is the ethical alternative to the riba system where I have something extra, you want it. You want 1,000, you can have it, but you pay me back 1,500. That's absolutely unacceptable. That is what? The worst of sins that could be committed. If there's any other sin that can compare to it, I still need to be told about it. But someone comes to who? Imam Malik rahmatullahi alayhi. And he says that, I've told my wife, if riba is not the worst sin under the sun, then you are divorced. And Imam Malik tells him to come back the next day, I don't have the answer right now. He comes back the next day and says, I'm sorry, your wife is divorced. Why? Because I found in the Quran what? Is there any other sin to which Allah Ta'ala says, فَأْذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ? There are many sins. There is zina, and there's lying, and there's cheating, and there's stealing. But this is here war of Allah, war against Allah and His Rasul. فَأْذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ. So the worst of sins, one of the سَبْعُ الْمُبِقَاتِ, one of the worst sins that can be committed. But it is something which is so innate, which is so instinctive within humans. I've got more. You want it, you can have it. But at what? You can have it at a cost. There's a cost attached, being attached to money. Islam says, no, that cannot be. Now, this condemnation of riba is not specific to Islam. It's not specific to Islam. Every religion, every revealed religion has condemned riba. Be it Judaism, be it Hinduism, be it Christianity, be it South African law for that matter. South African law up to not very long ago, it had a law. It's got this very funny name in Afrikaans. Die Woekerwet. People don't even know what it means any longer. The Usury Act. The Usury Act stood until a few years ago, 2-3 years ago when it came out with the NCA, the National Credit Act. Woeker, riba, usury is condemned in South Africa. Cannot have it. But what did the West do? The West, with the Enlightenment, when they started realizing, man, we are sitting with surplus funds. There was no institution richer than the Vatican. The Vatican has funds not just for Africa. It has funds for every continent in the world. What do they do with it? Eventually, everyone is starting to lend money at interest, and they started going the same route. And they started relaxing, but they couldn't open the door completely. What they said is that we will set a percentage. We will set a percentage. Under that percentage will be what? Under that percentage, we'll call it interest. Over that percentage, we'll call it usury. So if it's regulated by percentage, it's interest, and that's a euphemism. Now, euphemism, we call it by another name, and it doesn't sound so bad after all. About 2-3 years before Jan van Riebeeck landed at the Cape, something started happening in Western Europe. First of all, there was the break between what? In the 1500s, Martin Luther, Zwingli, John Calvin and others started the Reformation. And what came about? They're breaking out of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, under the hegemony of the Pope and the structures of the Church, they were the ones who make law, everyone else follows. What then happens? A group of priests decide this is not the way it's supposed to be. They say we're going back sola scriptura. Scripture only. Don't give us what the Pope says. We don't want what the Pope is saying. We only what does God say in the Bible? That's all. Only scripture. A kind of Christian Salafi kind of thing. We just go there and everything else. We don't want any mujtahid to say anything. We'll go directly to the Nas. In this process, what they started doing as well, once they had separated from the Catholic Church, the Catholics are on the one side, the Protestants are on the other side, now it's open for every person to give his own interpretation because there's no priesthood left any longer. The Church, the Catholic Church, managed to maintain its hegemony on account of the priesthood. They managed to do so on account of the priest. Now, what's a priest? There's a difference between when we say al-ulama, warath al-anbiya, and when they speak about kahanut, when they speak about priesthood. What's priesthood? You need to be formally inducted into the priest. You don't just become a priest by studying. In this case of ours, innal ulama lam yuwarithu dinara, innal anbiya lam yuwarithu dinaran wala dirhaman wa innama warathu al-ilm faman akhadha wa akhadha bihadhin wafir. You study up to a certain level, you become an alim. No one needs to. The turban that they put around your head is just a formality which many probably did not even have. But you study up to a certain level, you become an alim. Do you then need to go to a specific process, lie on your face in the church all night long, the next day the Pope comes and blesses you and inducts you? There's none of those things. Do you need a certain special kind of permission before you can start doing the confessional and forgive sins? The priest forgives sins. There's no such a thing. مَا يَغْفِرُ ذُنُوبُ إِلَّا اللَّهُ. Only Allah forgives. We do not go to a priest for that. So these were all the things that they rebelled against, and they said, no priesthood. But what we do have in Islam is, we have scholarship. So there's a difference between these two. But now, going back to Europe in the 15th century, they break away. As they break away, something else starts happening. Political power is gradually separated from religious power. Authority of a religious nature and authority of a temporal nature is being separated from one another. Once upon a time, Everyone used to be subservient to canon law, which is kind of the fiqh or the sharia of the Catholic Church. Now, the rulers are saying, we're not under church any longer, but we still need a law. So how is law going to be made now? Law is going to be made by secular authorities. Those secular authorities go the direction of saying, forget what the Pope is saying. We are going to say, under 5% is interest, over 5% is usury, and what happened in the process? The ancient condemnation of usury, the door was open to it. The door was open to it, and it wasn't long before all of Christendom were into it. Because the Catholic Church then realized, well, those guys are making strides. They were speaking about what? They spoke about something called the Protestant ethic. So if you're a Protestant, you work hard for your money. And you are a tradesman. You work for your money. And money needs to circulate in society. And therefore, some people should lend it interest. The church then realized something. The church realized something. If we don't get on board, we're going to be left behind. So they had a school. They had a school, what do you call it? A seminary. Seminary somewhere in Spain. It's called the School of Salamanca. And the School of Salamanca then started looking for ways and means, hiyal, for the church to enter the entire industry of lending at interest. And quite a few interesting hiyal they eventually came about with. The bottom line of it all was, it wasn't long before everyone was doing riba. Before them, long ago, Allah Ta'ala had told the Jews already, they're not supposed to take riba. وَأَخْذِهِمُ الرِّبَى وَقَدْ نُهُوا عَنْهُ. Allah Ta'ala has cursed them because of the taking of riba, but they had been prohibited from doing so. How did they justify themselves? لَيْسَ عَلَيْنَا فِي الْأُمِّيِّينَ سَبِيلٌ. He says, as far as the Jews are concerned, we can't take riba from the Jews. But as far as the Arabs are concerned, they were living in the Arabian Peninsula, the non-Arabs, the non-Jews, the Gentiles, we can take from them by all means. After the year 70 AD, when the Jews were carried off into exile into Europe for the next 2,000 years, they could barely engage in the more honorable professions that Europe had to offer. So what did they do? They went into lending at interest. And very soon you find the image of the Jew as shown by who? Dickens shows it in Oliver Twist, or rather, what is Shylock. The Jew becomes a Shylock. The Jew bent over like a hunchback, but collecting what? His interest. That was him. And then Shakespeare also immortalizes it where? The Merchant of Venice. The Merchant of Venice, of that Jew who wants his pound of flesh. So Europe had this image of the Jew that was a despicable image that eventually gave expression to itself in what happened with the Jews between the two world wars, led to the Second World War. But anyway, those were the professions that the Jews were engaging in. So every other society prior to Islam, every other religion, every other great thinker, every other great guide of mankind had condemned usury. And all of them, some point or the other, had given in. Every civilization, there's this very interesting paper making its way around on the internet for a few years now already. It's been updated recently by a Scottish economist called Alistair McIntosh. And he writes together with a South African economist by the name of Kevin Peterson, the cricketer, some other Afrikaner sounding name, and I can't just place my finger on it right now. But there's this paper going about, and it speaks about the history of usury. In the history of usury, they survey every civilization, from the Jews to the Hindus to the Christians, great thinkers, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, everyone, the condemnation of riba for a number of reasons. And then they recount how every other religion had compromised on this most fundamental of principles of a just economic order. And they come eventually to the point that says only one community there is who never gave in. There's only one community that decided that this is the uncrossable line. This is the line that we will not cross. But it is not sufficient to say that we will maintain our condemnation of it on the one hand. That's not sufficient. We cannot merely condemn. Condemnation, outlawing something, saying that it is not permissible, is only half of the answer. The other half is produce the alternative. Because commerce is unavoidable. The exchange of funds, the owner of excess funds will some or the other find some way to employ his funds in a way that others will be using it. Either through loans or through partnerships, whatever it might be. every other society. Why did they fail? Why did they eventually compromise? Because they failed to produce the alternative. They failed to produce the alternative, so haranguing against the evil of usury. It's only half of the question. It's only half of the answer to the timeless question. It is not allowed. That's half of it. So what do we do? What is the alternative? No one produced an alternative. Except for Islam. Islam, in its time, from the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam to the Khulafa al-Rashidin, to the Imam Mujtahideen, it started producing the alternative. That alternative, when Islam reached up to North Africa, the other way around, the Syrian coastline, that which is today Palestine, Lebanon, and the Syrian coastline, crossing into what is today Turkey. Two sides of the Mediterranean Sea were what? Controlled by Muslims. It wasn't long before the Mediterranean Sea became a Muslim lake. Controlled by Muslims. From the time Sayyidina Muawiyah, Ibn Abi Sufyan radiallahu anhu, sent out the first Muslim navy, and the Ghazwa of Dhatu Salasil took place. What was it? Dhatu Salasil. Yes. Dhatu Sawari, I'm sorry. Dhatu Sawari, the Battle of the Masts, where they defeated the Romans. Thereafter, others came. Cyprus was conquered. Crete was conquered. Sardinia was taken after. And the Mediterranean Sea became a Muslim lake. Now the Mediterranean Sea has for ages, for hundreds of years before that, been one of the most important avenues of commerce. It's been one of the most avenues of commerce. From the one side, ships will sail to the other side, take goods from that side, bring it to this side. And for a long time, they had been trading. The Romans were trading, the Greeks were trading. History usually just hands down to us who conquered who, which battles was fought between who. But there's another side of human expansion. There's another side of human interaction. And that other side of human interaction is trade and commerce. And then there would come a time later on, which we'll speak about shortly, when commerce and military expansionism would join hands. Coming to that in due time. But for this moment now, the Mediterranean becomes a Muslim lake, controlled by Muslims. And inevitably, Muslims are going to do what? The dominant civilization leaves its imprint on the other civilizations around there. Historians of commerce, it's a special field of history, neglected most of the time because military history is what we look at most of the time. But historians of commerce have traced commerce in Europe. And they found that the most potent vehicle for the expansion of Europe that started from after the Enlightenment and the voyages of discovery, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, leading to colonialism, the most potent form of business partner, of business organization that led to this and gave Europe the impetus it required was the modern company. Oh, partnership is a partnership. You put money, I put money, then we trade together. But the modern company, with its additional aspect of limited liability and the manner in which it allows for countless numbers of individuals to contribute to that central pool and eventually all share in the income that comes from there. This was the tool through which Europe eventually came to dominate the world. Has it ever struck you as uncanny that it was not the British government that conquered India? It was the British East India Company. That it was not the Dutch government that conquered the Cape. It was the Dutch East India Company. Still till today we call it the Company Gardens. Up to 1857, India was ruled not by the crown. India was ruled by the company. And only after the 1857 jihad against the British, did the crown step in, dissolve the company, and say, we are taking. Only then did Victoria become the Empress of India. Before that, who was ruling? The company was so powerful, the company had its own armies. The company had its own ships. The company had its own petty rulers ruling all over the show. This was when commerce joined hands with military expansionism, leading to what? To the phenomenon of colonialism. What spearheaded the West's penetration and domination of the Muslim world was business. It was not purely military. It was business and military expansionism joining hands together. And suddenly, our countries fell like dominoes one after the other. We couldn't stand against such might. Because the commercial impetus joined to what? The need for new markets, the need for new sources of raw materials to exploit, to take advantage of, these things combined in a manner that just made the West an unstoppable force. And our countries plummeted one after the other, and they simply walked in and took us over. Well, many of those states, we probably have to say, they were probably hollow from the inside already. They were hollow from the inside, it just took someone to come and tip them over and they fell. But anyway, قَدَّرَ اللَّهُ وَمَا شَاءَ فَعَلْ وَكَانَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ قَدَرًا مَقْدُورًا. We suddenly found ourselves on the back foot. Now when this happened, we found ourselves on the back foot, a major seismic shift took place with regard to Muslims, their Sharia, their civilization, their way of life. I just want to go back to something which I did not complete previously. The major tool, the major instrument, the spearhead, the head of the spear through which they penetrated into our countries was the company. Where does the company originate from as a form of business partnership? Where did it originate from? Several have written on it. I'd make reference to one of them. Abraham, why am I forgetting his second name now? Not Abraham Geiger. Yudovich. Abraham Yudovich of the University of Princeton. He is a commercial historian of the Muslim Middle Ages. He investigates the issue. Now many, you know, the tendency with Europe, all things great come from the Greeks or the Romans. So they found this great thing, the company, which is different from a partnership. Where did this originate from? They say, well, amongst the Romans, we used to have something called a commendas. A commendas is a form of partnership. They took that and they just adapted it from there. Some would say, no, it's not the commendas. It's another form of old Roman partnership called the societas. They took it from there. Others say, no, the Jews had an old kind of commercial partnership called the isca. They took it from there. It's from here, it's from there, it's from there. This Jewish scholar at Princeton University surveys all the possible routes that the modern company could have, and he says the only one which has which displays all the features of the modern partnership upon which Europe could have possibly based it is the Mudaraba of the Muslims. How did they learn it? From the Muslims who were the masters of commerce in the Mediterranean. There was a time when we were the dominant civilization, and the dominant civilization gives to the other civilizations all of those aspects, all of those techniques, all of those forms of business that it had developed within itself, take it, here it is, take, and have a just economic order. In a way that the one who contributed the money and the one that contributed the labor, the two of them can share it equally. Other writers thereafter, Murat Çizakça of the University of Bahçeşehir in Turkey writes about it, and he affirms the same point of Yudovich, and he also records there the opinions of other Western scholars such as John H. Pryor of the University of somewhere in Australia, who has a big problem with this. Why? Going back on the old European bias, it could not possibly be from the Muslims. But the basic would say, well, perhaps they used the Muslim one and a few other ones, but they cannot deny the fact that the Islamic roots that it has. So like Islam gave them that, Islam had given them so many other things, they write further to say that the Mudaraba form of partnership that would eventually become the modern company, the echoes of it and the effects of it could be felt where? It was not just around the Mediterranean. You could see similar partnerships arising where? All the way up to Finland and Scandinavia, and all the way into Manchurian China. If there ever was an example of Sayyidina Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam being rahmatul lil alamin, this is one of those examples. What he had brought, the just form in which people should do business, not the kind of form, I take your money, I just give you a fixed amount and I take all of the rest. No, equally sharing between the two. People found it so just, people found it so viable, they found it so efficient, just about everyone adopted it. Civilizations take and share from one another. They take from here, they give to there. To demonstrate the point, these days we have something called a check. A check is a very common instrument that we have. Okay, these days probably with cards, checks are losing their position. But once upon a time, just about everyone knew about the check. Check, where does it come from? Where did they come with it? That word check, they say, comes from the Arabic word saq. Once upon a time, you write a document, I owe so-and-so so much money, or this one is lent from that one, and that is stamped, that's a saq. The saq eventually became a check. In Western Europe, it became a check. And that was the time when we were the givers and they were the takers. And as the case would be, the wheels of history turn. And as they turn, we are at the bottom, we become the takers, and they become the givers. We borrow back from them what we had originally given to them. Sok became Czech. Czech came back to the Arab world. They speak today about a sheikh. It's not a sheikh. It was originally a Sok. Arabic became Western, let's say English for that matter, and is retranslated back. And now suddenly becomes what? A sheikh. And the original, this is an example to demonstrate how civilizations have borrowed from one another. Here we stand at the dawn of the colonial era, spearheaded by these great companies, Dutch East India Company, British East India Company, and so many others. These were probably the two most prolific ones and the two most powerful ones that controlled the greatest colonial empires. But the great seismic shift that I spoke about earlier that had occurred with colonial domination is the fact that our Sharia was supplanted from the courts and supplanted from society by new systems of law. When the Dutch stepped in to the East Indies, when the British East India Company stepped into India, the Qadha courts were abolished. The moment the Qadha courts were abolished, what was brought in their place? British courts with British judges. This is now a British country. It's part of the British Empire. Well, initially, just the fiefdom of the British East India Company. But Sharia went out of the back door. It didn't recede from society altogether. It still existed within the hearts, within the minds of the Muslims. But practice where? Practice in our ibadat, perhaps. As for the muamalat, you can, on your own, practice. But we know, we live in societies in which commerce has been going on for how long? And how many of those traders would actually consult? Say, look, I'm trading in this particular way. Is it right? Is it in line with Sharia? Or is it not in line with Sharia? Bank loans would be taken. Bank monies would be deposited within banks. And at times the question would be asked. At times no questions would be asked. Investments would take place on the stock market. And few questions asked. And when the question is asked, then there is a hunt. Then there's the fatwa shopping kind of thing. Go around till you find the fatwa that you want. And at the time, there was also very little understanding of the institutions of a Western economy. Because when the West eventually withdrew from these countries, they came to us when we were countries that were, how shall we put it, at a very, very rudimentary stage of an economy. As economies, they were very agrarian economies still. It was still economies in which your backbone of your economy is agriculture. Farmer plants, farmer harvests, farmer brings to market. He sells on the market, and from there the wholesalers and the small buyers and sellers, and that's how it will go. That's your economy. That's basically your economy. They came to our countries, and they had by that time taken over not just the business form of partnership, they had also taken all the physical sciences developed in Baghdad. Once upon a time, all those ulama were sitting there. Ahmad Shawqi says, "Da'anka Roma wa Athena wa ma hawata." As much as they speak about Roman and Athens, leave all of these things. Kullu al-yawaqiti fi Baghdad wal-yutumi. All of these great things, you'll find it right there in Baghdad. Wada'ra amsisa inna al-mulka mazharahu fi qimmati al-adli la fi qimmati al-harami. Justice is at the top of any society, not the great pyramids that Ramses built in Egypt. So we had all of this greatness once upon a time. The sciences based upon experience, all of those things upon experimentation. It was being developed. Dr. Fuad Sezgin. Dr. Fuad Sezgin is a Turkish scholar based in Frankfurt in Germany. And he's made it his life's work. He's written a book, initially he wrote a book in German. It was written originally in German and then translated into Arabic. It's called Tariq al-Adab al-Arabi. Now, Adab here doesn't mean literature as we know it. It means the entire spectrum of things that were written by the Arabs. And in this book, he would make mention of which authors wrote which books in which subjects. That's how he started out. And no, those subjects would at times be history and hadith and tafsir and fiqh. And also the sciences. Then he started focusing upon the sciences because he had been documenting, tabulating and documenting all those great books written, scientific advances by Muslims, be it in the field of astronomy, be it in the field of medicine, be it in the field of the experimental sciences. Then he went on to a practical step. He said that, let's get those books, the manuscripts of those books. Let's study what they had in them. And in them you find very precise descriptions of how to build those instruments that those Ibn al-Haytham and Ibn al-Nafis and all of these people were speaking about, and he started rebuilding all of those instruments once again. And right now he has a center in Frankfurt in which he puts on display all of those things. You can see the signs of the Muslims over there. The stages, the heights that they had reached, Europe has taken all that over. Europe has developed itself and became an industrial power. Now once upon a time, you want your ship to sail, you need what? You need oarsmen who will pull this. Suddenly you have what? You don't have that any longer. You have steamships sailing all over the world. Once upon a time, your caravan has to march through the desert from one point to the other. You don't need a caravan any longer because you've got a steam engine. You've got a locomotive that will take it from one point to the other. You're revolutionizing society all the time. So what they brought to us was a very advanced kind of economy. An economy in which goods are delivered from point A to point B within a tenth, a twentieth of the time that it took before. So our countries initially did not have all of that. It was still the old agrarian system. Suddenly what happens? They leave our countries. What did they leave behind? They leave behind systems. They leave behind banks. They leave behind insurance houses. They leave behind factories. They leave behind railway systems. All of these things. And it came upon us very, very fast. It wasn't given the same amount of time to develop as it took in Europe. They developed the product and it was simply left in our countries by the first half of the 20th century as they started destroying themselves with the First World War. And then the Second World War, they realized the colonial project is no longer on. We can't maintain world empires. We need to give them independence. Two reasons. The first reason was they couldn't maintain it any longer. They had expended themselves. Second reason was, they had already plundered as much as they had wanted to. Europe is still today rich on account of what? All those plunder that they did once upon a time. If they are able to give pensions, if they are able